Okay, we're going to go ahead and call the finance meeting to order. Please shut off cell phones, or we'll be having donuts tomorrow. See, for the record, yeah, somebody's supposed to bring donuts.
Mr. Holmes.
I'm still getting used to this. Yeah, there's Jim back there. We did donuts? I must have missed the donuts. Yesterday.
Did we have finance yesterday?
I don't think so.
We'll discuss that after the meeting.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, am I directed to discuss it with my staff?
We can make that happen.
Okay. Yes, would you please, Representative Holmes? Okay, for the record, it's 1:35, and with us is Representative Holmes, Representative Kelly, co-chair Representative Schnultz, Representative Hocker, and joining us also is Representative Paul Seaton. Before we get started today on our overview with the PERS insurers, we have just a few housekeeping things we wanted to go over, especially with the new members who may not know how the Finance Committee has been run in the past. And first, what I'd like to do, so that you really know who runs the Finance Committee meetings, is introduce you to Luann Christian, who is our House Finance Secretary. She's the nuts and bolts behind our operations here, and she's going to kind of tell you what you can expect as far as when to get the bills, how to get the bills, and then introduce the rest of the staff. So, go ahead.
Okay, well, I'm going to try this. I'm going to walk around because what I want to show you is in the room, and I have this new technology of a wireless mic, so if you can't hear me, just let me know. But our primary function here is to help keep you and the committee organized. So any logistical issues, anything like teleconference requests, missing bill files, or if you can't find something in your backup, you can just get my eye contact. I or someone from my staff will be sitting here in this chair during the meeting, and we will jump up, and if you need coffee or anything you need, just call us. Any policy issues, anything on amendments, CS and so forth, that I will refer back to the committee chairman and staff. We have various pieces of information around the room. Behind Representative Foster and Representative Calvin Holm, these black books are the detailed budget books that's been given to us by the governor's office. One set has been sent to the office of each subcommittee chair. We keep a couple of copies in here. You're welcome to come up and look at them or sign them out if you need need to look at them in depth. We also keep copies of the short forms, both the governor's proposed and what was actually enacted last year. And we are keeping copies of those in this drawer right here. So again, if you need that kind of information, you can just catch my eye and I'll jump up and get it for you. Oops. Also behind each member are two drawers with their names on them. The top drawer, when we get a bill into committee and it's actually scheduled for a hearing, we'll make up a bill file for you and we will put backup information in it. We will store it right in the front of the top drawer where it says bills on agenda. If we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves and we've got our bills made up for the rest of the week, we do have places, we have headings in here Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So if you're looking for a bill, it should be for that week, it should be right here in the front of the drawer. Once we hear the bill, you can leave your files right on the table, or if you want to carry them off and take them to your office, that's fine. If the bill is still being heard, it's still active, we'll put it back in the top drawer. If it's inactive, if there's no longer, you know, it's moved out of committee, we'll file it down here. Again, you're welcome to pick them up. If your staff wants to come and look at the backup information prior to the meeting, they're welcome to come and get it out for you and look at it. But I want to emphasize to the staff and to you, when you come in, if your bill file is missing and we are filing information, it's not uncommon to get different pieces of information trickling in up until the meeting starts and even after the meeting starts. So if the bill file is not there, what we will do is just file it on your desk for you, right where you're seated. So if you come in and you've got a bunch of papers here, you can let us help you, or you can just pick up and see it's a committee substitute and it goes in this file. So if your staff has taken the files, I would really be advised to have them bring them up before noon of that day. That way we can minimize how much newspaper you have and have to deal with. It just helps you to find things. We have boxes in front of you. Each one of you will have a name, and we'll keep it stocked with a pad and pencils and things like that. Those are for your personal use. If you have anything you want to put in them, vitamin C toward the end of the session, whatever it is, we don't get into that except to make sure that they're supplied. If you leave any personal things on the table, any letters that you were signing for constituents or anything like that, we will put them in your box. If the box gets too full, we'll just ask your staff to come up and grab it and go through it and figure out what to do with it. We also wanted to tell you about the new recording system. We do not have enough mics for everyone to have their own individual mic at this point. They're set up and they're very sensitive, so we should be able to pick up your voices where they are without you having to move them around. However, if I notice that we're not hearing you, I might come and fiddle with them and put them close to you. These mics are very sensitive, and we do have a new recording system now, which is digital. So everything that the mic picks up will be put onto the internet, and I do not yet know the timeline of how long it's going to take data processing to get that information on the internet. But I just want you to be advised that that they are sensitive enough that if I were back by Sharon, you would still be picking me up to some degree. And if you're having a conversation that's not the primary conversation, it will be heard to some degree. You can, however, mute your mic by pushing on the little button here, and the green light will go off. If we have an at-ease or an executive session or any kind of break in the official hearing, we will mute everything in the room. The media gets muted, the recording gets muted, the mics get muted, the room PA gets muted. So in those times where you want to have free discussion and not worry about it, we will be muting that, and you will know because this green light will go off. And that's pretty much it. I want to introduce my staff. Zoe in the orange shirt, or peach colored shirt, will be helping me with the files and so forth. And then we have Nancy Thomas and Char Smith as our secretaries this year. And I'm kind of a swing person, so you will see me come up and type at times. And we try to keep it so that none of us are, you know, sitting at the table too long without being able to stretch. That's all. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Lynn. Yeah, Representative Foster.
I want to thank Luann. Today is Cher's birthday, and she's been here, I think, longer than most of us, or all of us here, at least 15 years, and she helps make sure that this finance runs smoothly throughout the session. I want to thank her on behalf of this committee for all the hard work she's done and to wish her a very happy birthday, and I was hoping that the committee here and the audience would join Representative Holmes in meeting us and saying happy birthday to you.
Very good. That seems to be in order. Go ahead.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Sean. Happy birthday to you.
Char, did you want to defend yourself?
Sort of.
Well, happy birthday, Representative Foster. Thank you for putting that up. There are some other housekeeping rules that we need to go over, but instead of keeping the audience here to listen to our rules, we'll go on into today's presentation and pick that up later. I think I see some other legislators in the office or in the room. If you want to join us here, please do. Welcome Representative Wilson, Representative Guttenberg. Representative Jewell has now joined us on the Finance Committee, as has Representative Foster. And oh, we got Representative Weirock. He's hard to see. Okay, so at this time, why don't we go ahead and have the presenters with the person tours join us. I understand Melanie's Milhorn's going to do the presentation. Of course, we have the commissioner here, and I've been practicing your last name, Matuszewski.
Very close.
Matuszewski.
Okay.
All right, good. And Kevin Brooks, deputy commissioner, is here with us. And online is Robert Reynolds. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm online.
Okay, good, good. So with that, those introductions, Nolly, I'm going to turn the presentation over to you.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to come and meet with House Finance this afternoon and provide an overview on PERS insurers. This is going to be a joint presentation, and I invite any of you, if you have questions, to please just ask those questions, and we'll try to answer those as we go along. Bob Reynolds will be covering some of the presentation, and I will be covering some of the presentation as well. So starting on page number one,
okay, you're referring to the book?
There's a handout presentation.
Do the audience have them too, or is it?
There's some more on the table.
Go ahead.
So, PERS and TERS has three operating policies that work in concert together for the retirement systems. And those three policy areas include the investment policy, and that is with the Alaska State Pension Investment Board. The benefits policy is the purview of the legislature. And the funding policies are administered by the Public Employees Retirement Board, the Teachers Retirement Board, and the Commissioner of Administration. On the funding policies, the Public Employees Retirement Board looks at the assumptions, adopts the assumptions as recommended by Mercer. They also establish the employer contribution rate annually. For the teachers' retirement system, in statute, they do not have the authority to set the employer contribution rate. However, they make a recommendation to the Commissioner of Administration. And turning your attention to page number two, this particular one-page summary is divided in half, and it looks at the critical areas for the Public Employees Retirement System and our current funding status, and then for TERS on the bottom half of this sheet. And at the very top, it talks about the measurement year. The measurement year is the actuarial valuation year. And the most recent report that we have is as of 2003, as of June 30th, 2003, which sets the employer contribution rate for FY06. In March of 2005, we will have a new valuation report for PERS and TERS prepared by Mercer, and that will be as of June 30th, 2004. The Public Employees Retirement Board and the Teachers Retirement Board will meet in April to review that valuation and set the employer contribution rate for FY07. So looking at those critical areas right at the top, the investment return, it is assumed that the Public Employees Retirement System will have will achieve an investment return of 8.25. And looking at the actual investment return for the valuation of 2001, 2002, and 2003, you can see that they did not achieve this targeted investment return, which, turning to the second portion, the cumulative shortfall, by not hitting the 8.25 investment return results in a cumulative loss to the system of 34%. One area that we've spent considerable time researching and analyzing is the medical cost to the system. And the medical cost to PERS represent 40% of the accrued liabilities, which is significant. Based on the valuation report as of 2003, the board adopted an employer contribution rate of 16.77. The recommendation by Mercer, based on the funding of the system, Their recommendation was 25.63. So we are not at the calculated rate, which has the consequence of adding additional liabilities to the system when you do not achieve the calculated rate recommended by the by your actuary. Turning now to the funding ratio, so what the actuarial valuation report does is it's a snapshot in time. It looks at the assets, it measures the assets for the system and the liabilities of the system, and it determines what your funding ratio is. And what that is designed to do is to say, as of that date, if you needed to pay all of the liabilities to the system that were due at that point in time, you would have 72.8% of the needed assets in order to pay those liabilities. Obviously, that's not going to happen, but that's what the valuation report is designed to do. The amount that you want to have in your system at all times is 100%. If you ignore the medical cost, which is right at the gray line of the retirement system, actually the system is funded for the pension side alone at 121%. When you add in the medical component, then the system is funded at 72.8%. And the reason that we put this in the summary sheet is because PERS and TERS are atypical as compared to other pension systems. They pre-fund for the medical component of their systems. And there's only three other states besides the state of Alaska that do that. And we're going to touch on that information a little bit later to really underscore why that is so significant to our systems. But that's the purpose of making that comparison in that area. Turning down to the teacher's retirement system, the same kind of information about the actual investment return as compared to the targeted investment return, which is 8.25, representing again a 34% loss to the system. Looking at the healthcare costs used, you can see that as of the valuation of 2001, the health trend was at 7.5, and that changes as of the valuation of 2002, which that assumption was reset, and that added significant liabilities to the system, and we'll talk about that a little bit further, why that was difficult for the actuaries to actually determine what that health trend should be. It's very volatile over some period of time. When you look at the funding ratio for TERS down at the bottom, and you ignore the medical component, the system for TERS is funded at 89.5%. When you include the medical component, it's funded at 64.3%. And turning to page number 3, which we talked about a little bit earlier, GASB, which is the Government Accounting Standards Board, had a ruling in August which will require all pension systems to account for their medical liabilities much in the same manner with the state of Alaska, with the exception that it does not require pre-funding. That is very, very significant. And it requires that those medical expenses be accounted for on an accrual basis. So if you look at other systems and the liabilities, the accrued liabilities for PERS is 40% and for TERS it's 28%. If other systems are out there that have those kinds of liabilities as of 2007, 2008, they're going to have to record those. The very bottom line indicates that if they are fairly significant, that it can actually affect that state's bond rating.
Excuse me. So
we are in compliance with GASP.
Exactly. There will be no, this will have no impact on PERS and TERS whatsoever. They actually began that process in the 70s.
Okay, so it just impacts, like, I think you said 47 other states, or there's three states like Alaska.
Right. Ohio, Michigan, and Kentucky are the three other states that account for their liabilities on an accrual basis and also pre-fund. So those are the states that we have comparable funding ratios with.
And if I may, so even though we have some challenges with our system, it's still better than most states.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. And now I'd like to turn the presentation over to Bob Reynolds, starting on page number 4.
Thanks, Melanie, and thanks to the committee for the opportunity to speak here. What I'd like to speak to are the next 4 pages, which deal with similar content in the presentation. So those are pages numbered 4 through 7, I believe, in your handout. Melanie talked earlier about what we call the funded status of the system, which is a measure of the assets of the system, how much money is available to pay benefits relative to what we call the liabilities of the system. And the liabilities represent a measure in today's dollars of the benefits that have been earned in the past within the system, so the benefits that are payable to retirees as well as the benefits that the active memberships have earned based on their service so far within the systems. And we compare the assets to the liabilities and arrive at what's called the funded ratio. If the funded ratio is 100% or higher, that means there are sufficient assets in the system to pay for the benefits that have been earned so far. If the funded ratio is less than 100%, that indicates that there is some shortfall of assets relative to liabilities that will need to be made up in the future in order to ensure that the benefits are fully funded. Slides 4 through 7 address the question of changes over time in the funded status. In the last 3 years, there has been a decline in the funded status of the systems from in excess of 100% for the PERS, close to 100% for the TERS, to the levels that Melanie quoted earlier of 72.8% currently for the PERS system and 64.3% for the TERS. So there's been a fairly steep decline in the last 3 years. If you look back over a longer time period, and that's what the information in these pages does, we look back over approximately a 10-year period, what we find is that there was an increase in the funded status from about 1992 until around the year 2000, and then a decline, and the decline was coincident with investment losses in the marketplace as well as changes in the costs of medical benefits as well as the perception of what those costs might be going forward. Now, in any time period, there are a variety of things that can happen that can influence the funded status of the systems. And the pages 4 through 7 are an attempt to look back in time and articulate what those effects were and what their effect on the funded status has been. So slides or pages 4 and 5 show that information graphically. And what it shows in each year from 1993 through 2003 is the effect of 6 types of influences on funded status, and those are listed on the right-hand side of each of pages 4 and 5. There are some assumption changes, and they've been divided out between non-health and health-related assumption changes, demographic experience, which is changes in the membership population and its effect on funded status, plan changes, which are changes in benefit levels, and those are changes in benefit levels as a result of either legislation or post-retirement pension adjustments approved by the board. Medical experience which is increases in medical costs that are different from what we have assumed in the valuation, and investment experience, which is returns on the fund assets that are either higher or lower than we assume in our work. So slides 4 and 5 show that information graphically, and Millie and Vision on the bottom of the page in a legend have added additional detail on those changes for more recent years. So for example, if you look at page 4, in 2001 there is a cost, a funded status decline associated with a plan change, and that particular plan change was HB 242. So slides 4 and 5 show that information graphically. On page 6, and I'd like to perhaps direct your attention to that, we show the information numerically.
Bob?
Yes?
We have a question here. By the way, I want to welcome Representative Croft to Representative Croft.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I should know, but what did HB 242 do?
House Bill 242 had two primary components to it, and it was retiree return, so to deal with retention kinds of issues for teachers and for the public retirement system. And also the second component is that it did enhance medical benefits for police and firefighters after 25 years of service. They were provided system-paid medical, and for teachers as well, after 25 years of service, they were provided with system-paid medical benefits.
I remember now.
And for Tier 3, at age 60, it allowed them to not pay half of the premium.
Mm-hmm. And just as we go through it, I'm interested in how we meet this. It's, if you read these graphs, it's sort of an overlay of the stock market. That purple is the stock market going up and then down. Again, and over them, superimposing assumption changes and plan changes. That's why I asked about this. But it seems to me, in the discussions we had last year, that we've exacerbated a stock market issue and to some extent a medical cost issue with some changes in assumptions or plan changes. You can see the yellow and the purple on sort of taking a bad stock market situation and making it worse. And so I want to understand and be convinced that those those assumptions changes in how we believe the modeling is done. They're different to me than the investment situation, which you can't do much about, and the demographic, which is provable. And we want to respond to these are things we've decided to change in the midst of an already difficult situation. And so as you go through this, and I apologize for interrupting, I'd love to know more about particularly the assumption changes. I can't change the stock market, but I can have some say on what we use or don't use in the PERS calculation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Continue, Bob, please.
Yeah, sure. And to speak briefly to the question raised, I agree that you can't necessarily influence the stock market. What we're doing, though, in our work is estimating the liabilities of the system. And the liabilities of the system are our estimate of the value in today's dollars of benefits that, for the most part, will be paid many years in the future. You may have active members who currently are 40 years old, and we're estimating the value in today's dollars of the benefits that will be paid for the remainder of their lifetime. So they're a long time in the future. We're making a variety of estimates as to what future investments might be. And while the stock market, I agree, is not within any one individual's control, we are making an estimate about what we expect investment earnings to be, and that is one of the more important assumptions we make. So investment experience is an important part of the assumptions as well. On page 6, we separate out, first of all, there are two numerical charts on the page. a smaller one about midway down the page. And what that page does is look back to 1992 and separate out the change in funded status between assets or investment performance and liabilities, which are the other factors we've talked about, which include demographics, assumption changes, and plan changes. And what these graphs point out is that although assets have been a very large influence over the last 3 years in terms of the funded status, if you look back 10 years, the contribution that the assets have made to the change in the funded status is not as large, because clearly the history is that the last 3 to 4 years in the stock market have been down years, with the exception of a more recent year. But if you go back 10 years, you include within that time period the run-up in the markets that occurred in the 90s, and so those balance out. And what this shows is that for PERS, assets contributed a 3.8% to the decline in funded status. And for TERS, the assets or the investment performance contributed to a 2.7% decline in the funded status. So what we find is that although assets underperformed our assumption over that time period, they didn't underperform by very much. And in fact, the majority of the change in the funded status comes from the liability side, where on the PERS, the funded status has decreased 18.5% due to the liabilities, and for TERS, 26.6% over that time period. Now, the bottom chart on the page breaks up the liability side further into some of the factors that we just talked about on the colored graphs. It breaks it out into health experience, health assumptions, plan changes, demographic experience, and non-health assumption changes. So, for example, looking at the teacher's retirement system, health experience decreased funded status by 3%. Now, health experience, what that represents is how have medical costs changed in the past relative to what our assumptions would have predicted. Health assumption changes for the teacher system caused the funded status to decrease by 4.7%, and that's the other side of the health experience equation, which is not looking backward and how costs have increased relative to expectations, but looking forward and saying, have our expectations for health cost increases in the future changed? The answer was yes, and that led to a decline in funded status of 4.7%. Plan changes we talked about. For the teachers, that decreased funded status by 5.3%. over the 10-year period. Demographic experience changes in the population caused a decrease in the funded status of about 6.8%. And non-health assumption changes, things like mortality rates, salary increases, termination rates, and retirement rates, etc., caused a decrease in funded status of 6.8%, for a total then of 26.6%. So there wasn't necessarily any one factor for the teacher system that contributed more than roughly a quarter of that 26.6% change, but there were about five factors that were significant contributors. And on the left-hand side, we show corresponding figures for the PERS system, the same factors creating decreases in funded status of 6.9, 12.5, 4.7, and demographic experience and non-health assumption changes actually increasing the funded status of the system to arrive at a total of 18.5%. Are there any questions?
Yes, Bob. Representative Croft.
What health assumption changes did we make that had the dramatic impact on PERS, to a lesser extent on TERS, and what non-health assumption changes did we make that had that dramatic impact on TERS?
First of all, to address the health assumption, the primary assumption change is what we call the health cost trend rate, which is the rates that we use to predict how health costs will increase in the future. In 2000, we performed what we call an experience study for the PERS and the TERS board, and at that time, it was decided that the rates that we were using to project health cost increases into the future needed to be revised upward. We used the same, because health costs are universal rather than being a feature necessarily of one of the systems being different than the other, we used the same assumptions for the two systems. The effect on the PERS system is much larger because medical costs are a bigger part, are a bigger share of the total system cost for the PERS than for the TERS. So the increase had a bigger effect on the PERS, not because the assumption is different, but because of the portion of plan costs that medical bears for the PERS being higher than for the TERS. And there's some information later in this presentation that Melanie has that will illustrate that point. The non-health assumption changes are a combination of assumptions. There are retirement rates, salary increase rates, termination rates, and mortality rates that are all studied every 5 years. And the combined effect of those was different for the two systems because the studies are based on actual system experience, so different recommendations might be made, for example, as to termination rates for the PERS system than for the TERS. That may help to answer the question. There is a detailed assumption study report available from the year 2000 that would give more detail on each of the individual assumptions and the effect that each individual assumption had on the funded status.
The overview of page 6 is essentially that rising health care costs have had a much bigger impact on the PERS-TERS situation than the stock market if you take a slightly longer view.
That's exactly correct.
And our assumptions about what medical costs are going to do over the long run in the future had the biggest, at least in PERS, by far the biggest impact on this situation.
Yes, that's correct. There is some information later in this presentation that gives a historical overview of medical costs and what they have been, gives a little more detail on what our assumptions are, what they have been, and what they are in the future as far as medical costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Croft. Representative Wilson, did you have a question?
Thank you. I think I'll wait. I had the exact same question as Eric did, but I will wait because it sounds like they'll go into a little bit more detail later on, so I'll just kind of wait on that.
Okay, thank you, Representative Wilson. And also, I want to welcome Representative Newman for joining us. If you can find a chair, you're welcome to sit here, or else if you're comfortable there, it's fine too. Okay, please continue.
All right, turning to page 8, this particular one-page summary provides information about the different tier levels and also the various different categories. And what it's designed to do is take a look at the universe of the population who either are currently receiving a medical benefit under the PERS and TERS system, are an active employee who may in the future receive a medical benefit, are deferred vested and have satisfied the criteria to receive a benefit in the future. And so when you're looking at that population, as of December 2004, there's approximately 27,095 members who are receiving a medical benefit. And when you add the dependents who are covered under the PERS and TERS plan of 24,947, the total medical benefits for covered individuals, there's 52,042 members who are currently receiving a medical benefit, which will be ever increasing. Last year, we retired approximately 1,800, and that is expected to increase. And turning to page number 9, that's the historical information about the premium.
You know, Melanie, I have a question.
Sure.
Maybe I missed this up here, but if everybody was to retire today, we would have enough to fund 72% of them. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And obviously that's not going to happen. They're not all going to retire today. So is our ratio, our current ratio, okay, or are we...
We actually, when we compare and contrast ourselves with other plans, we feel as if, and I think the research, Bob can speak to that as well, is our funding ratio is fine.
Okay.
We especially when you add in the component that we pre-fund for the medical aspect.
Okay,
did you want to elaborate on that, Bob?
Yeah. I guess being an actuary, it's hard to answer a question, is the funding ratio okay? But instead, I guess my point would be, what are the financial implications of it? A couple comments. One, you know, on a survey, if you survey retirement systems around the country, I think what Melanie is saying is exactly right. The funded status of the Alaska systems is good relative to other systems around the country, and in particular the fact that these systems have been pre-funding for the medical liabilities puts them well ahead of the curve relative to other plans around the country. So I think if you, on a survey side, I think the funding ratio looks relatively good. Historically, if you look back in time, the funding ratios have been at similar levels in the past. If you go back to 1978, for example, the PERS funded ratio at that time was 69%, and the TERS funded ratio was 68%. And over the ensuing 20 to 22 year periods, each of the systems' funding ratios improved to over 100%. So in a historical context, there have been time periods when the funding ratios have been at their current levels and perhaps a bit lower, and they have improved over time. As far as the financial implications, though, looking forward, the implication of a 72% funded ratio for PERS is that when we do our valuation, we calculate what the rate will need to be in order to arrive at 100% after 25 years in the future, and the rate that we arrive at for the PERS system is 25%. So while historically and compared to other systems, 72% does seem relatively okay, if you were to attempt to reach 100% over a 25-year period, it would require a calculated contribution rate of a little more than 25% for PERS. And likewise, to get to 100% after 25 years for TERS requires a contribution rate of nearly 40%.
All right. Thank you for that explanation, Bob. We do have a question from Representative Seach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 2, we're looking at PERS and TERS, and you have about 3/4 of the way down in the PERS section. You know, the current contribution rate is 16.77, and the non-medical benefits only, that's the second to the last line, is at 121%. And if we compare that on TERS, we're looking at a 21% rate, and we're looking at only 89% of the benefits only. Can you explain to me what the difference is? I mean, do we have one retirement system that is just paying higher benefits than the other, or why is there such a difference that the one that has the higher rate is actually funding at a much lower, we have much less of the liability covered?
Let me try to answer that. The calculated rates are based to a large degree on the funded status. So the PERS system, the funded status is better. It's 73% compared to 64% for TERS. So the rate that we calculate is lower for the PERS than for TERS because PERS has the better funded status. So we are calculating a rate of 25% for PERS versus 38.85% for TERS because the PERS has a better funded status and has less ground to catch up, basically. The rates that the other rates you quoted, the 16.77 and the 21%, those are the rates that the boards have adopted or recommended, and they reflect our calculations as well as projections into the future, and to a large degree for the PERS, for example, they reflect that individual employer rates cannot increase year over year by more than 5%. So that's why for PERS, the rates have gone from 6.77 to 11.77 to 16.77 in attempt to work their way towards our calculated rates, but taking into account the limit on annual increases of 5%. The TERS does not have the same 5% per year increase, but they have adopted a similar policy of taking steps over time in the direction of the calculated rates.
Okay, go ahead, let's proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess rather than the total benefit liability, I was looking at the non-medical benefit liability separated out from medical, and you know, we're looking at a huge difference between PERS being funded at 121% of liabilities on non-medical benefits and PERS being at 89%. And I'm trying to figure out why this large difference in the unfunded liability for PERS and TERS when actually TERS is contributing, will be contributing at a higher rate.
Now, let me clarify. Did you say that PERS would be contributing at a higher rate?
No, TERS.
TERS would be, right. And the reason for that is that the calculated rate is based on the funded ratio for total benefits, which includes medical. The non-medical benefit funding ratios are shown for comparative purposes with other systems because, as Melanie indicated earlier, most state retirement systems do not pre-fund medical. So the non-medical benefit liability ratios are shown for comparative purposes with other systems, but the calculations are based on the funded ratio for total benefits because the systems are pre-funding medical. So as far as the rate calculation, it's the 72.8% and the 64.3% that go into the calculation and not the 121 and the 89.
I'll have
a follow-up
later.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob, I have a question on which one of the plans, PERS or TERS, if I remember correctly, we have to increase the, when we increase the amounts, one of them is limited to 5%, isn't it?
That's correct. Okay. And that's PERS, and it's by regulation, and that regulation was recommended by the municipality of Anchorage to the Division of Retirement and Benefits in 1991, and it was for budgetary purposes, and it's capped at 5% annually, that the rate shall not be increased or decreased by 5%.
Follow up with that. Mm-hmm. So I guess my question is, do we need to change that percent? Should we change it? I mean, should somebody change that? Is that why the adjustments are different sometimes on one plan and the other, because Anchorage doesn't want it to be any more than 5%? I mean, I'm just trying to understand why we're limited by the 5% in one plan and not the other.
Right, and there's some more information in the presentation where you'll be able to look and see what the board has adopted for PERS and what the board has adopted for TERS. The Commissioner of Administration has the authority to set the rate for TERS. I'm not sure that the regulation itself needs to be changed unless the thought would be to arrive at a PERS employer contribution rate that would be at the calculated rate faster than the 5%. And that, of course, would have some consequences. There are some some pressures associated with increasing that rate above 5% and going to the calculated rate of 25.6 immediately. So it could be done. The regulation could be changed, certainly.
Just to follow up with that then. So right now, looking at these, we can see that each year we're a little bit more behind, or not behind, but we went from 30% in PERS to 38% to 40% of our PER liabilities. And by next year, is that going to be higher because we haven't reached it? So the next year is, we add that on plus what we were behind from the year before.
Representative Wilson, that does have a consequence when you do not adopt the calculated rate by Mercer. And what it does is, as of the valuation for 2003, it adds additional liabilities to the system. And for TERS, that percentage that was added to the employer contribution rate as a result of not hitting the calculated rate was 1.1%, and for TERS, as of the valuation of 2003, it added additional 1.4% to the employer contribution rate.
And does it look like that we're going to have to add another percents in the coming years?
Yes, that's anticipated right now.
Thank you, Representative Kelly.
Just a comment so we don't misinform anyone. It seems to me that a survey like the one you quoted that says we're doing relatively well is like a survey in a boat harbor during a storm where we've got 8 feet of water in all of the other boats and ours only has 6. And as a former employer, news that I was going to pay, you know, $1 out of every $4 of salary to maintain this thing, or $4 out of every $10 of salary, wouldn't be good news, or I wouldn't think we were doing rather well. So I guess I just wouldn't like anybody listening to this to think that that we don't have one tall problem.
Yeah, Representative Kelly, I appreciate that comment, and we do realize that this is a matter that is very serious, and we are concerned about it. Obviously, we would prefer to be 100% funded, and we recognize the pressures that this puts on budgetary issues for employers, certainly.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Please continue. I think I might have interrupted Bob. Were you done, Bob?
No, I think Melanie was on page 9.
Okay, thanks.
So page number 9 is the historical premium cost for PERS and TERS. It also has the annual percentage change column, which I'd like to draw your attention to. And we talked earlier about determining what that what the health trend should be based on the actual year after year change. And it was difficult for the actuaries, not just our actuaries for all systems, to be able to look at that year after year change. For example, in 1989, with an increase of 51%, followed by the next year, 1990, at 20%, followed by a negative 4 the year thereafter. It's very difficult to have a trend line that determines hereafter it should be, you know, 10%, or it should be 11. Obviously, we've reset that trend line to 12% based on the historical annual compounded increases over some period of 10 years, which is around 10%. The division has also, in this last year, because we are very concerned about the medical costs and the rising medical costs, and how do we make changes within the constraints of the system that we have right now. Obviously, the state of Alaska's PERS and TERS system did have a lawsuit in 2001. The Alaska Supreme Court told the members and told the state of Alaska that you cannot diminish or impair changes to the medical plan. So we have some constraints there. However, working within those confines, what are the measures and what are the actions that we can take in order to reduce our medical costs? And so some of those initiatives that we will be undertaking, one of them includes positive enrollment for our active and our retiree population. And what positive enrollment entails is that we require the members who are covered under the plan to provide the division with documentation supporting that indeed these individuals should have coverage, and that's standard, that's pretty industry-wide, that you do a positive enrollment with your membership, you provide your marriage certificates, your birth certificates, those types of things. We discovered recently that for our retiree plan, we have a summary plan document that outlines what the benefit provisions are to members. And we discovered that we were not in compliance with the statute for coverage of dependents under age 23. And so when we identified that group, we sent letters to all the retirees who had covered members. There's about 2,600 that received letters. And we told them that we needed to receive positive documentation that, in fact, their covered dependent was enrolled full-time in school. And that was not outlined in the summary plan document that they received. And as a consequence, Aetna uses the summary plan document, and they never made a requirement of that retiree's dependent to ever show proof that they were, in fact, enrolled in college. Those letters went out in September to the population, 2,600, and we let them know that if we did not receive that documentation back in January, that we would have to discontinue coverage. We received back about 1,300 supporting documents. So that is of concern to us, that this was an issue. We're dealing with it. But it shows us, that there's some cost issues that we're working very hard to address. We also, there's an initiative that's been underway for some period of time, and it's between the board and the division, and it was an initiative where we educated members about the costs of prescription drugs, and the In doing so, we wanted them to move from brand drugs to generic drugs. And when they surveyed the current use a couple years ago, it was at 37% that used generic drugs. That's been moved to 42% as a result of this educational process. And for every 1% movement from a brand prescription to generic drugs, it represents a $1 million savings to the plan. So it's substantial. And we continue to work on those efforts with our retirees. We also engaged in, there was a 5-year contract that was signed with Aetna, which Aetna is our third-party administrator for claims administration, and there's 2 1-year renewals. And this last year, we exercised one of the 2-year renewals, and we spent some considerable period of time with Aetna in order to look at that contract and to come to agreement on what those administrative fees were. We were presented with their fee schedule in February, and it took us 6 months to complete that process. The basis, the reason why it took so long is we told Aetna that we needed to, our commissioner insisted that those costs be reduced. And we worked very, very hard with Aetna. Obviously, we have a long-term relationship with them. They recognized our fiscal issues, and we entered into a contract that's a flat fee contract for 2004-2005, meaning that those administrative fees were not increased for our retiree population or our active population. It resulted in a $350,000 immediate savings on the administrative fees associated with Aetna. And then we entered into something that's very unique. It's called a negotiated or a network guarantee with Aetna, and Deloitte Touche helped the division craft this amendment to the contract. And what it's designed to do is Aetna has guaranteed to the state of Alaska that through their various different networks, they will provide to the state of Alaska realized network savings. This will be a process that will be reconciled a year later. In 2002-2004, the network guaranteed savings that the state of Alaska received was $23 million. And what we're targeting and what Aetna is guaranteeing is that that will be $31 million. And if they hit that $31 million, we've agreed to provide approximately, and it's limited, they can only recover about $472,000. That's the maximum amount, and that's in exchange for hitting a target to the state of Alaska of $31 million. So we're pretty excited. This is new territory. It hasn't happened before, but we're hoping that it achieves the results that are desired.
No, we have a question. Representative Stokes.
Yeah, this is perhaps more appropriately, the gentleman behind you, Mr. Matuszewski, is there's a lot of pressures in our system to some coming from our branch and some are going to be coming from the executive branch to add new coverages to health insurance and amend retirement programs. I guess I want to, if I can get a pledge of accurate and full cost fiscal notes and even projecting, because we're trying to dig ourselves out of a hole, and I guess the press and some of the other folks were tired of that cliche about when you're in a hole you stop digging, and that's, I guess, if you'll help us keep informed consent so we don't dig deeper. And if we do proceed forward, tell us all the pitfalls, even if it's your own boss's bill.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, thank you. Ray Matuszewski, Commissioner, Department of Administration. Yeah, you give us the time and we will give you the best numbers we can. All of the numbers put forth by Mercer, our actuarial consultant, are their best effort, very educated efforts at determining what those costs will be going into the future. I know it's difficult at times to gauge what the impact, how many people will take advantage, for instance, of enhanced medical benefits, how many people will leave the system prior to those becoming available to them. But we're so we're very, very concerned about the funding status of these plans right now, and so yeah, any legislation that would negatively impact the funding status is of great concern to us, and you can have that pledge that will give you the best numbers available to us. As long as we have the time, I mean, in deference to Bob on the line there, it does take them a bit of time to actually grind through some of the assumptions when legislation is changing quickly.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner.
Turning to page 10 of the presentation material. This provides a 10-year comparison of expense by the different types of the pension benefits. Beginning in 1995 through 2004, the health care benefits, obviously, you can see that those costs are rising, and they're rising at a rate that are of concern, obviously. The one positive note that I would draw your attention to is that in 2004, under the administrative expenses, there was a reduction. And actually, our budget for FY 2004, our authorized budget was $11.4 million, and our expended budget was $10.2 million for FY 2004.
Representative Holman has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Melanie, when I look at these, I can't determine, and you have somewhere a graph somewhere that determines the growth of the number of employees or the number of retirees versus the dollars. In other words, what I see here is just a dollar increase, but I don't see if it's commensurate with what's the percentage difference between the number that are retiring today versus the number that we started with.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any?
I don't have that in the presentation material, but we certainly do in the evaluation report, and I can follow up and get that information for you, Representative Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you. And on page 11, it's the very same material, only it's specific to the teacher's retirement system. Down at the bottom, the graph just shows by proportion the pension benefits, health care benefits, refunds, and administrative costs. And then, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question on that page. I'm not sure I know what you mean by refunds. And the refunds are, there's quite a difference in the refunds from PERS to PERS. Can you just explain that a bit?
Well, the refunds deal with the employee who elects to refund their benefit out of the system. That is their contribution and their interest to the account. It is not the employer's contribution to that account on their behalf is not part of the refund to the system. So when an individual elects to refund their account out of the system, that's what those that category represents.
So you're saying that state puts in, the person puts in, and the person decides to take their part out? Is that what you're talking about?
That's correct. Okay,
thank you.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And turning to page 12, that's a one-page summary that looks at some of the critical areas for PERS and TERS that we discussed earlier, but it gives you a snapshot beginning in fiscal year 1997 for the investment return, what the assumption was, and what the actual return for PERS and TERS was for that period of time. Also, in the middle is the medical assumption. So the assumption that's used by the system, the annual change, and then the compounded change that occurred over that period of time. The mortality table was changed in 2002. That was an assumption change, and when the mortality table was changed, it added approximately 2.8 years of additional benefits to every benefit recipient. Obviously, individuals are living longer, which is the good news.
The bad news.
The bad news is the cost for
them.
Yeah. And then on the far left hand of the page is the employer rates, the actuarial computed rate, comparing that to what the board adopted. You'll note for TERS that there's a number of years where TERS did not adopt the recommendation by the actuary. And then it also has the PERS calculated rate and what the board's adopted and the difference.
Can I ask?
Sure.
A couple of this chart interested me. The medical coverage chart you had before showed medical costs compound increases stabilizing at 10%. The longer you looked, the harder they set to 10%. That was on page 9. Go back to 78 and compound annual increase, it hardens out at 10%, right?
Mm-hmm.
And over that long term, the medical cost rate is 10%. And over the last 10 years, I just calculated the last 10 years in that actual medical annual change quickly, and it's averaged 9.4%. So either over the very long term or over the last 10 years, the change has been between 9.5% and 10%.
That's correct.
Yet we have over the last 3 years, essentially the 3 years where this crisis on PERS and TERS has come up, estimated 12%. If we estimated 10%, the historical average and the 10-year average, it seems to me this problem goes away, doesn't it? I mean, with a 10-year medical cost estimate going forward, we're overfunded.
Mm-hmm.
This is Bob Reynolds.
Go ahead.
To understand the rates that we're using requires looking at more than 1 year. What we're doing in when the assumption says 12%, that means we're assuming that for that particular year, looking 1 year ahead, medical costs will increase at 12%. What we do when we look a long time into the future is we have a scale of rates into the future, and they start at 12%, but after 3 years, they decline by roughly 0.5 percentage points per year, so that after about 15 years, we arrive at a long-term assumption of about 5%. The weighted average of those rates is probably close to 10 over that time period, but it starts high and it trends downward, still arriving at a long-term rate that is in excess of general inflation. If we were to change to a 10% looking into the future forever, we would actually likely arrive at liabilities that are a little higher than what we're currently anticipating. The problem that we have and what the academic community in general has with an assumption like 10% forever into the future is we find that medical costs essentially become almost the entire gross domestic product. So we reach an untenable conclusion assuming that medical rates remain at that level indefinitely, and the only way then to arrive at a reasonable conclusion is to assume that at some point in the future medical costs will come down.
All right, so that, just a couple more, that 12 is not, that's a starting rate, but that's not what you predict for the long term. You bring those rates down.
We do bring those rates down, and they're shown in the detailed valuation reports, the exact table that we use.
Okay, and a similar question on investment return. Our 10-year average investment return for both TERS and PERS is over 9%, 9.1 or 9.2. It seems to me that what we have is not a problem, but the prediction of a problem. And go ahead.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. We are attempting to estimate the cost today of events that will happen, in some cases, many years in the future. So you're right. It's not a current problem. It's a predicted problem.
And what is the volatility on that? That is, we set it at, started our medical rate change at 12. It's been historically 10. If we're off, I mean, if we instead used 11.5 or 11 to start it, how much does that affect the magnitude of the problem?
Yeah, I can't quote off the cuff the sensitivity to the liabilities of a 0.5% change in the current trend rate. Certainly it would bring costs down, but you're certainly not in the situation where the 70% budget status suddenly becomes 100 with that sort of modification.
Thank you.
And turning to page 13, provides a 5% increase by category, assuming that the Public Employees Retirement Board adopts a 5% increase beginning fiscal 07 through FY09. And one thing that is important to keep in mind is that these increases are additive. So when the average employer contribution rate is at 16.77 and then that rises by another 5%, is that that's additive. It's added to the base and then it's an increase of 5%. And pages 14 through page 17, Jerry, is it?
Oh, that's in Wilson's
slide. I'm sorry, I have a question here too. What is the difference in these numbers? Because I think that the school districts, the municipalities, it's different from the university because the university is a defined contribution plan, where the rest of the state is a defined benefit plan. And if we made a change to the future. I know you can't change the past, but for the future employees, if we change them from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan, how would that affect all of this, and would it?
Mm-hmm. And actually, we've done quite a bit of analysis, and that was part of the TIER initiative that took a number of months. We worked in concert with four different TIER members, two from PERS, two from TERS, and then Mercer over a number of months. And we looked at that very issue. What would happen if, going forward, new TIERs were established for PERS and TERS, and what would that do to the employer contribution rate, recognizing that the unfunded liability must be paid off at the same time that a new TIER initiative was established. And there's actually some presentation material that will show you, and Bob's going to address, what that does to the employer contribution rate over that 25-year period in order to pay off the unfunded liability, but also adding a new TIER to the system.
Thank you, Chairman. Can we just go back to page 12 for a moment on the mortality table? My understanding is that we do have the new 2004 federal mortality table. I see it to be adopted or to be determined which one we're going to use. My understanding is that we got a significant part of our liability came from not adopting the 94 liability table until 2002, and then that was a huge jump going back calculation. I guess what I'm trying to do is figure out where our liability trend is if we adopt the 2004 mortality table currently, or if we wait 5 years and then suddenly adopt it and have to back calculate 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. Is that something
you
look at?
Bob, could you?
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'd be happy to talk to that point. First of all, to clarify, the 1994 mortality table was adopted in 2000, and that was adopted as the result of a periodic assumption study that is performed every 5 years for the PERS and the TERS, at which point we make recommendations as to what we think the appropriate assumptions are for the systems, and those assumptions, after discussion and possibly revision, are adopted by the boards. So the 1994 table actually was adopted in 2000. That's for fiscal year 2002. The effect of the new mortality table has perhaps been overstated to some degree. The effect of the mortality table was about a 5% decline in funded status. There is a newer mortality table available now, which is based on a table that was published in the year 2000. There is a scheduled assumption study for later this year or early next year, at which point it's very likely we would recommend to the board the adoption of this more current table. The effect of the new table remains to be seen. The new table will not necessarily uniformly increase mortality rates, one reason being that the new mortality table allows for separate tables based on the type of the workforce. So for some workforces, the new mortality table will increase the liabilities. For others, it might not. The effect of deferring such a change is simply that what we're doing in doing this work and in recommending the assumptions we do is making our best estimate of what the liabilities of the systems are. If you defer such a change, you're essentially ignoring a cost component that is likely to come to bear in the future. It doesn't increase your future liability, but what it does do is you lose several years of funding towards that new liability. It's basically, an analogy would be if you're saving to buy a house and you think you can buy a house for $100,000, but it turns out you need to pay $120,000. The cost of the house hasn't increased. It's your perception of it that has. And what you've lost is the time to save for it.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Sure, go ahead.
Well, in our case here, then it probably wouldn't make any difference because we're at our 4 or 5% limit of growth in the savings for the first-insured rates anyway. So we would be calculating some rate above, but we wouldn't be making any savings because we are, at least as of last year, growing at our maximum rate of contribution. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Okay.
Back on page 12 real quickly. TERS kept their rate pretty steady at 11 or 12 while things were going up and down around that. And PERS seemed to be much more volatile and in retrospect, seriously undersaved in that period where it's sixes and sevens. Am I reading that right?
I'm sorry, yes. There was a time period where the PERS rates that we were calculating were in the 6th and 7th range. And as I said before, the calculated rate is to a large degree a function of the funded status of the systems. At that time, the PERS funded status was actually in excess of 100%. So looking forward 25 years, the rate that was required to stay at 100% over that time period was considerably lower.
Hmm. Okay, and then will you calculate for me back on that medical and return, if we used 10 instead of 12 on medical and 8.5 instead of 8.25 on investment return, whether we get to 100%? What percentage we get to? 10, and then you're declining whatever formula you use, but started at 10.
Yeah, we can certainly do that work and talk to the division about it. My only comment would be that, of course, ultimately the assumptions are the purview of the boards.
Okay.
Please continue, Melanie.
Comment. Along that same line as Representative Croft, if we had a sensitivity, Melanie, on the different areas, then we could do any one we wanted without picking the same one as it'd be easy to march around with it. Understanding that it can get behind the looking glass pretty quickly if you decide to adjust it by playing with it. So
but it would really be helpful if we knew what the impact would be so that we can do our own playing with it.
Right. Look at different scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And actually, Bob Reynolds is going to continue on page 18.
Okay. Yeah, moving ahead to 18, the next several slides, in fact, I believe the remainder of almost, except for the last two pages, which are a historical timeline, the remainder of this deals with projections that we've done for the boards in either our valuation work or in conjunction with our work with the TIER committee. So on page 18 and 19, what page 18 shows is some of the assumptions behind page 19, the graph. And what page 19 depicts is our expectations of what our calculated contribution rates will be in the future under three different scenarios. And those three different scenarios are scenarios related to future investment returns. So underlying all this, the assumptions are that, first of all, population increases at a rate of about 1% per year, which is consistent with at least recent history for the system. we assume, of course, that the calculated rate for the PERS system can't increase by more than 5% per year for the individual employers, as per the regulation discussed earlier. And then the chart at the bottom of the page describes each scenario that we're looking at for future investment return. One is labeled base case, which essentially assumes that investments will return 8.25% per year in the future, with the exception of fiscal year 2004, where we have inserted the actual return that the investments earned for that fiscal year. The next column over is labeled growth, and that is simply a somewhat more optimistic investment scenario that has 4 years of investment performance that exceeds the 8.25% that we assume. And on the right hand, there is a scenario labeled prolonged recession, which is a very negative future investment scenario with negative returns for 4 years, then returns that level out, but still level out at a lower rate than we're assuming at this point, the 8.25%. And then the chart on 19 shows what future contribution rates will be under each scenario. And so you see the base case is the solid line in the middle. The optimistic growth investment scenario has somewhat lower contribution rates to the future than the small dashes. And then, of course, a prolonged recession is the longer dashes, and it results naturally in rates in the future that are considerably higher than they might be under the base case scenario. Under the base case scenario, we find that rates, of course, we expect to increase at 5% per year for the next several years. And then we see that rates do continue to increase in the future, in part because of the fact that it is taking some time to get to the calculated rate. There's a lag. And also because there are various systemic effects that contribute to gradual long-term increases in rates, so that you see at the end of this time period, the rate for the PERS system, we expect to be somewhat in excess of 30%. Pages 20 and 21 show the analogous information for the teacher system. 20 shows the assumptions, and they're essentially the same. One point perhaps to make is that although the TERS system is not constrained by the same 5% increase per year regulation that the PERS is, we were asked to and have built that constraint into these projections. And so then page 21 shows our expectations of how the PERS rates would increase in the future. You see that under the three scenarios, but in particular under the base case scenario where investments return 8.25% over the long term, we do see that rates continue to increase from their current level of just under 39% to rates that are in excess of 50% over this 25-year period. So those are our expectations of where rates might be in the future under these various assumptions as to investment returns.
Yeah, Bob, we have a question from Representative Croft.
So, am I understanding that right? Whereas we're used to a world where it's from 7 to 12% contribution rates, you're saying for the next 25 years we've got to get used to a world where it's a third to a half contribution.
Yeah, the calculated rates right now, as we talked about earlier, are 25% and 39% for the two systems. What those rates represent are the contribution levels that need to be sustained and even somewhat increased for the next 25 years in order to arrive at a funded status of 100%. So the intention is in the 25 and the 39% rate is not to get to 100% by the end of 1 year or even 2 years. That's the rate that we anticipate it will take to get to 100% after 25 years.
Okay. Dr. Wilson, any questions? Okay.
right. Thank you, Bob.
Slides 22 and 23 address the question that was raised earlier about the defined benefit versus defined contribution plan or a possible tier alternative. These are charts that were developed in conjunction with our work with the tier committee to predict the effect that a new tier might, what effect a new tier might have on contribution rates in the future. And not just any new tier, this is based on a particular new tier that the committee was focused on at the time, and there is a great deal more information on this available from the division, and much of it, I believe, is posted on the division's website that describes the new tier that was being considered and gives more information about the financials and the benefit levels of those new tiers. But what these slides show then in particular is just what impact that particular new tier might have on future contribution rates. So, for example, again, focusing on the PERS system on page 22, the solid line is the rates that we're predicting under the current plan, and this is the same information as I just described under the base case investment scenario. It shows rates increasing 5% per year to a level in excess of 25%, and then continuing to increase for the next 25 years to a rate just a little over 30%, and then declining at that point, because as I described earlier, the intention in the calculated rate is to reach 100% after a 25-year period. So you do see that 25-year period reflected in the decline in the rates at the end of this chart. The dashed line shows the impact of what this particular new tier would have on rates in the future. And so what you see is that over time, this new tier would result in approximately a 7% decrease in contribution levels relative to the current program. If you look at 2028, the projected rates are under 25%. They're about 24% compared to about 31%. So that's a 7% decline. But what it shows is that it takes many years to realize that full savings. The reason being that it is exactly that. It's a new tier. It affects only new membership to the system, and so it takes quite some time for the system membership essentially to turn over and to be composed in significant measure of people within the new tier. Page 23 shows similar information for the TER system, and essentially it's the same message. You see the solid line shows our expectation of what rates would be for the current program in the future, and the dashed line shows the impact of a new tier. The scale is different, but it does show essentially the same decrease in contribution rates over that 25-year period of about 6-7% between the solid line and the dashed line if you look out in 2018, but shows the same similar slow phase-in effect of the savings, in that it takes quite a while for system costs to be based primarily on the new membership.
Okay, we have a question for Representative Kelly.
This is strictly focusing on the employer, so we need to add, to find the total cost of this program, we need to add in the employee contribution.
That's correct.
So it carries forward in all of these. And have you done anything with changing the employee contribution? Have you done any alternatives?
We have. We were asked to look at that in conjunction with our work for the TIER committee, and the committee did arrive at rates that were different from the current program. I don't recall exactly what they came up with, so I can't quote it, but I would say again that material is available on the division's website. Or we can provide a copy of that material.
It would just be helpful, Mr. Chairman, to see a sensitivity like the last one that would relate to that, and that would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. And I can answer that question, Representative Kelly. For PERS, the employee contribution rate with alternative one and alternative two is set at 8% right now. By statute, it's 6.75 for all others, and it's 7.5 for police and firefighters. And the rate would be higher for police and firefighters. For the teacher's retirement system, they're currently 8.65, and that would increase their rate to 10%. And that was one thing that came out of the survey that the employers wanted to see, is that the employees bear a larger contribution to the benefits that they're receiving from the respective systems.
Thank you. Actually, Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what you're saying, we can see definitely that it would make a difference if we put something in place like now. Definitely down the line, it would ease the burden on the state, but it would increase the burden on the employees. Is that what you're saying?
It does have a consequence of shifting some of that risk. Right now, under our defined benefit plans for PERS and TERS, all of that exposure, all of that risk is exclusively borne by the employer. So the employer bears the risk when the investment loss is lower than expected. They bear all of the risk when the medical costs increase. Any changes in its assumptions, 100%, is borne by the employer. So yes, it would have that consequence of shifting some of that risk to the employee under alternative one and alternative two. Pretty substantial.
So they would be taking less home because of that. I mean, they might be helping for their retirement, but they would be taking less money home in order to do that.
When the employee contribution amount goes up, yes, that is accurate.
Now, is that when you did that figuring that, were you figuring it with the defined benefit plan as it is, and then looking at it if we changed it to a defined contribution plan, or were you just looking at it separately from the defined benefit plan and what the difference is if we just upped it?
Actually, under alternative one, what that configuration contemplates is its elements of both. It has a defined contribution portion and it has a defined benefit plan, but the defined benefit portion is vastly reduced. It's reduced to a 1% as compared to right now 2%, 2.5 as the multiplier, and then 2.5. So it's vastly reduced, and that's alternative one. And the remainder of the benefit is a DC portion that goes in. So the risk factor associated with that is that it diminishes the employer's risk for everything except the 1% on the DB side. Alternative two is an exclusive defined contribution plan proposal. So both of those were looked at.
Do we have the results of that?
No, all of that information is available online right now, and if at any time you would like to have a presentation, we would be pleased to provide that information on the TIER initiative.
Thank you.
Okay. See no other questions? Bob, I think to interrupt Bob or you, help me know. Go ahead, continue.
No, I'm sorry. I think that was all I had to say about slides 22 and 23, and so then I would turn it back to Melanie.
And just the balance of your presentation material, we provided timelines for PERS and TERS and the significant legislation that took period from the inception of these particular retirement plans, just for your background information. And that concludes our presentation, unless there's other questions that we can respond to.
Any other questions, committee members? Representative Hawker, you're doing a lot of work there. You have a question?
No.
Okay. All right. Representative Seaton.
Yeah, if we can go back to, say, table 23, or page 23, for 1 minute. As I look at that, it looks like that 2026 or 2027, we're still increasing the PERS rate, and then in to reach 100%, but then in 2028 we dramatically drop the rate. I mean, it seems like we should be asymptotically or some way reducing. I mean, even if we kept the rate high and didn't continue to increase them for a number of times, we would be getting to 100% funding. And is that just because we've artificially said 25 years and we're going to reach it then, and even if we drop dramatically after that?
Mm-hmm. When you're looking at that amortized schedule over that 25-year period, this graph shows what it takes to pay for the normal cost of your existing benefits and also the unfunded liability together. So when you get to 2029, what that contemplates is that you have paid off the unfunded liability and you go back to the normal cost rate for your benefits. The normal cost rate is the value of the benefits to the members as of the year that it's credited, as of that valuation date. And the normal cost rate right now for PERS is 13%, and for TERS it's 14%. So when you're looking at that calculated rate, the remainder of the 25.6 is the unfunded liability. It's the past service cost that's amortized over that 25-year period. So when that chart falls off, you're going back to your normal cost rate. Under both alternatives, the proposal would look at normal cost rates for PERS at 8%. If a new tier was adopted, alternative one, for example, the normal cost rate as of 2029 for PERS would be 8%, with a vastly reduced risk associated with that in the future. And for TERS, the normal cost rate, according to the modeling, would be 8.75.
And to elaborate a little bit on the question, I think the quick answer to the 25-year period is yeah, that is somewhat arbitrary. It's arbitrary, but it is based on a fair amount of due diligence by the boards on the effect of different amortization methods and different time periods. And that work was done both in conjunction with our assumption review that is done every 5 years, as well as an actuarial audit that is performed periodically, most recently in 2002 by an independent firm. So this methodology has been arrived at through a certain amount of due process. Around that, there are some, the Governmental Accounting Standards Board for calculating required contributions allows amortization periods of up to 30 years. So the 25-year period is close to, but not as long as the maximum allowed by the Governmental Accounting Standards Board. There is not a great deal of difference in cost levels between a 25-year period and a 30-year period. For analogy, if you think about the difference between a 25-year mortgage payment and a 30-year mortgage payment, it's not that different. There is a vast difference, of course, between a 5-year mortgage payment and a 30-year mortgage payment. To answer your question about an asymptotic method that might help to smooth this thing out, there are methods where you re-amortize the unfunded every year so that you don't get this plateau, this point in time where it drops off. The downside of those methods is that over time you find that you never really get very close to 100%. We're targeting 100% after 25 years. If you were to try to do an asymptotic type method, you would find that after 30 years or even 50 years, you're still only at 85 to 90% funded. So you really don't make the progress towards paying off the unfunded that you do when you impose a fixed amortization period like this 25-year period.
Okay, did you have a follow-up to that?
Yes, I guess I did. Well, let's say if we go out and we're doing this calculation now in 2010 and we're looking at a 25-year time frame, aren't we then going to be calculating past 2028, or are you saying that we're going to make this calculation at this one point in history and then we're supposed to just take the points off the graph and automatically do those for 25 years. I mean, it seems like you're going to be recalculating this in 2010 or 2015 with the 25-year time horizon, aren't you?
Well, this method contemplates that in 2010, you will be at that point in the graph and you will be looking forward to having paid off your unfunded still in 2028. So it is very much like a mortgage where you will have initiated the mortgage in 2005 and then 10 years later you will be five years into it and you will have paid off some of the principal and be looking forward to paying off the debt. To repeat what I said before, if you don't do that, if you retake out a new 30-year mortgage every year, then you never pay off your mortgage. You only get to, over a very long term, about 85 to 90% funded.
Okay. Representative Holt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I think that brings me down to what's the nitty-gritty here. I think you've fairly well laid out what the problem is. But my question goes to what's the administration's idea for fixing the problem. And I guess I'm glad the commissioner came back in. My question is this, Commissioner.
Go back out.
Given that the board has voted to not have a Tier 4, is it the administration's position to produce legislation to fix the problem? Or do you expect us to do it? Or some combination thereof? Or are you going to make one of these alternatives one of the pieces of the administration's legislative, one of your 30 bills?
Through the chair, if I may, Representative Fulham, unknown at this time. What I can tell you is what we hope to accomplish today, you said would introduce a new tier to fix the problem. You've seen to what extent a new tier might address the problem. Mm-hmm. It actually isn't a silver bullet. And one thing I've learned in the last 14 months in mulling around on these issues is there really isn't a silver bullet. A new tier is certainly one element in addressing, potentially in addressing the problem, one potential element of a solution. But our options are limited. We have a defined benefits plan. We have liabilities to anyone who's currently employed in the plan, anyone who's currently retired out of the plan. And so I can't tell you today whether the governor is going to introduce a bill. I know discussions regarding that are going on right now, and we hope to know soon if and who will be introducing legislation for a new tier.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, mm-hmm. if I could follow up. I guess my question is probably premature in the sense that we're not there yet, and we're not. I know the legislature is not ready to promote anything like that, but give me your thoughts about a defined contribution plan versus a defined benefit plan, which we have today. In the negotiations, and of course we're not privy to any of those negotiations for the numerous employees that you negotiate with, but is the administration considering pushing for a defined contribution plan or any piece of it like you're doing here? That is where you're trying to move to in your negotiations to help so we all pay a little bit? Is that the idea?
Actually, our pension plan is set up the statute. It isn't part of collective bargaining. And so the ability to create a defined contributions plan rests here either through the sponsorship of the governor with your help or through the sponsorship of the legislature. So the PERS system is a statutory benefit.
And just to follow up with the commissioner's comment, there's actually an AG opinion in 1978 that talks to that very issue, and it's not a negotiable item. That is strictly the purview of the legislature to determine the policy for those retirement systems. It's not negotiated. Which actually benefits the state of Alaska. There are other pension systems where that is not the case.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then, Mr. Chairman, if I could just follow up. This is, I'm going to kind of segueing into something else I really wanted to get to. As you well know, the municipalities have really taken a hit because they were part of the PERS and TERS, or the PERS in particular. And, of course, with our boroughs that are not
the municipalities, but the boroughs that are, like Fairbanks is not a borough, it's a borough and a city, or cities. Is there any administrative thought about putting forth some funding to help municipalities to help fund some of that problem this time around?
Well, if I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Holden, of course the governor's budget proposal does include funding the cost in the 5% increases.
The 5%.
Correct, for the next 2 years for both municipalities and school districts. And the vision there was until we corporately or all together achieve a more long-term solution, which I think hopefully you're all gathering is a fairly complex endeavor, that funding would be a good effort towards holding the municipalities, the local governments, and the school districts harmless for the next 2 year or the next two budget cycles from the increases.
So, well, I guess my question is 5%, the commissioner, is not anywhere close to what we know what the cost is.
5 percentage points. Remember, if I may, Mr. Chairman, the budget proposal envisions paying for the 5 percentage point increase per year. The employer cost increases for municipalities and for school districts.
Be allowable.
Correct.
Thank
which
you
it's
much.
Anticipated, if I may, will probably be suggested by the FERS board. It looks like they're going to bump it up 5 percentage points a year for the next few years to achieve a level that will begin to meet the calculated rate so that eventually it will come down.
Thank you for the clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Representative Crofts.
Yeah, on the proposed tier three or four, three I guess in TERS and four in PERS, what the chart showed to me was surprising in the how little impact a new tier has. I mean, in 15 years, it's only a 2% difference between the tier and the non-tier. In 20, it's three or four, depending on the chart. But that the new tier really doesn't get us out of this situation. And I worry, because the situation is fundamentally caused by things that are not related to that are caused by investment and medical cost increases and a lot of things that are the world is and the nation are dealing with, and it's not unique to Alaska. And, I mean, I just want to put on the record the cost that you have when you make the retirement system for teachers that much less attractive is in the schools for the next 20 years. The costs that you have when you lower the retirement benefit for state employees generally is in attracting those good people that we need. So there's costs and benefit in everything we do. The proposed benefit financially of a new tier is small, and I think we ought to remember the costs when we do this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Crofton. I guess today our intent is just to get an overview of the problem or the concern and not necessarily jump into the solution. Did you have a comment?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Croft is correct in the financial impact. It is modest over the extended period of time. But a point Melanie made earlier is worth remembering. A defined benefits plan burdens the employer exclusively with any investment risk, whereas our contributions in the future will be lower under a defined contributions plan. If the entire employee population becomes covered by a defined contributions plan, we would never be in an underfunded position again because the extent of our liability would be to make the payments per paycheck or per annum to the individual. And that's significant. It puts us in a different posture 20 years from now or in the future. That is very much worth noting, I believe.
With the employee having all the risk instead of us having.
Well, if it was 100% defined contributions plan, as many entities are moving towards now, that's exactly correct. It's all about who carries that burden. One other minor point, if I may, not to belabor it, but actually while we haven't done an extensive amount of evaluation of this, defined contributions plan for younger employees are actually found to be very attractive, attractive for folks for employment. The longer vesting schedule with a DB plan, you know, they're not as portable. So it's all food for thought, worth having a conversation. I thought it was important to point those elements out.
Very good. Don't go there, Eric. Representative Kelly.
On the alternative comparison one and two, did you apply the employee increase only to the tier four, or did you go back to the active tier one, two, and three? as well.
No, you can't by statute.
I understand
change.
That.
Yeah,
so we did. The statute's going to. Yeah. So you only applied it to the Tier 4, which would explain part of Representative Croft's point that it has a smaller impact because it's only packing the new people. It's not shifting anything into the larger cost.
That's correct, Representative Kelly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Jewell.
No, it's not pertaining to this particular one. Representative Holmes' comments with regards to municipalities, and I think that can be another time.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. See now. Thank you very much for the presentation.
Very helpful.
Thank you.
Okay, we do have just one housekeeping matter to take care of here very quickly. It's mostly for the newer members, since our procedure won't change anything from the past 4 years when Representative Williams and Representative Harris were their chairs. I just want to go over a little bit. For the most part, like I said, we're adjourned. We just want to go over some housekeeping items. I think on your desk you see an outline of the committee rules. And I guess I'll wait for Representative Holm here. This is mostly for. You should see an outline of the committee rules. And essentially, like I said, they're the same as what we've had in the past years. A couple things that I may highlight here is just that our meeting times will be. 1:30 till approximately 3:30. Sometimes we'll go over, and for planning purposes, you should plan Monday through Friday.